Welcome to a special Election Day edition of The Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. The Breach is a production of Rewire.news, your online home for cutting-edge reporting and commentary on reproductive rights, health, and justice. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Consider it an act of resistance. I've known today's guest since we covered Ned Lamont's Senate bid in the early days of the liberal blogosphere. His name's Ari Berman, and he's here today to talk about his jaw-dropping Mother Jones cover story about GOP voter suppression in Wisconsin in 2016 and how it might have tipped the key battleground state to Trump. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lindsay. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Can you start by giving us an outline of the logic of voter suppression, i.e. why Republicans do better when fewer people vote?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you looked at the two parties' electorate, Republican voters are more reliable voters. They're more affluent. They're more regular in terms of their habits. And Democratic voters sometimes are less likely to turn out. They also are more reliant on groups of people that might be younger voters, newer voters, not as familiar with the political process, or historically disenfranchised voters like African Americans and Latinos who face more barriers, both because of historic conditions and because of socioeconomic conditions today. And so Republicans have a theory that when fewer people vote, they do better. And that's proven true. If you look at 2010 and 2014 in the midterm elections, when fewer people voted, Republicans did much better. If you look at 2008 and in 2012, when more people voted, Democrats did much better. And so Republicans went into the 2016 election trying to figure out a way that they could lower Democratic turnout to gain a partisan advantage.
What are the major tactics of voter suppression that came into play in 2016?
So we saw a whole range of voter suppression tactics. People tend to focus on voter ID laws, and those are obviously very important, but it was beyond voter ID. It was cutting early voting. It was closing polling places, making it harder to register to vote, purging the voting rolls, disenfranchising ex-offenders. There was a whole range of things that were done to try to target Democratic-leaning constituencies. And I think this had, first off, I think it prevented a lot of legitimate people from voting. But secondly, I think it had an impact on the election in some very important states like Wisconsin.
What's the official rationale from the Republicans, their public-facing justification for making voting harder?
Well, their official justification is voter fraud. And they're basically operating on a premise that if you just say it enough, voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud, people will start to believe it. And they've been extremely successful in convincing their own base that there's massive voter fraud that benefits Democrats. During the entire 2008 election, we heard story after story about Acorn helping elect Barack Obama illegitimately. A poll showed that half of Republicans believed Obama was not legitimately elected because of fraud. But what's interesting is they prevented very little evidence of the kind of fraud that they claim to be stopping. So voter ID laws only stop voter impersonation, where someone pretends to be me, shows up, and tries to vote in my name. That's incredibly difficult to pull off without getting caught. And even if you pull it off, you're only chasing one extra vote. And so they haven't presented really any evidence of voter impersonation. So then they've moved to a different argument, which is that this is about protecting the integrity of the election, that as Scott Walker once said, just because your house isn't being robbed doesn't mean you don't lock the door. So when faced with no evidence of the actual fraud, they've moved to this other argument, which is about integrity in elections. Now, ironically, these voter suppression laws have done more than anything to undermine the integrity of the political process.
It's such a specious argument because you lock the door because other people don't have a right to come into your house. If people have a right to come into your house, then you shouldn't be locking the door.
Exactly. As you point out, the right to vote is not private property. I mean, this is one of the most fundamental rights in our entire system, and I don't think you should be able to restrict it without a very good reason. And it's very, very clear from many, many, many court decisions at this point that there's just no evidence of the kind of fraud that they're saying exists, or the evidence is much, much, much smaller than they claim to be. And so if you look at what the real rationale for this, it's always been about trying to disenfranchise people of color and Democratic-leaning voters. And that's why we saw this explosion of voter suppression efforts following the election of the first Black president in 2008.
Can you expand on that idea of election integrity and how voter suppression is compromising it?
Well, I mean, if people, number one, believe that their vote won't count, and number two, if people actually try to vote and they're not able to, and I've told dozens and dozens of these stories in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Texas and other states. What undermines election integrity more than people who are qualified to vote, who are legitimate, who have voted their entire lives, not being able to vote? And so you have a situation now where, you know, Republicans basically believe something that's completely untrue, which is that voter fraud is incredibly widespread. And many Democratic-leaning voters have a completely different experience, which is they feel that voter suppression is real. They've experienced it. And so both sides now have no real faith in the political process because one side is peddling a gigantic lie and the other side is feeling the real-world ramifications of that lie in terms of their rights to vote being their right to vote being suppressed.
What happened at the Supreme Court in 2013 to make it easier for the GOP to suppress votes?
Well, the Supreme Court gutted a key part of the Voting Rights Act, and they ruled that states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer needed to approve their voting changes with the federal government. What that meant was that parts of 16 states no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And it meant that states with the longest histories of discrimination, North Carolina, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, could put new voter suppression measures in place without having to approve it with the federal government, meaning that laws went into effect and then it was very, very difficult to challenge them. And so that Supreme Court decision took away the most effective tool the federal government had to stop voting discrimination in the places where it historically had occurred most often.
What reason did the Supreme Court give for taking these states off the prior approval list?
Well, basically what Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, said was that the country had changed dramatically since 1965 when the Voting Rights Act had passed, but that the Voting Rights Act had not, that it continued to treat states like it was 1965, like voter suppression was flourishing, when in fact things had changed immeasurably for the better. And what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said in her dissent was that that was like throwing away your umbrella because you weren't getting wet. It was still going to rain. Voting discrimination had not been eradicated. And just because there was higher black turnout, more black office holders, doesn't mean that you got rid of the law that made all of that possible. And in fact, what happened after the Supreme Court decision, the fact that 22 states had new voting restrictions in effect for the first time in the 2016 election, I think was the best rejoinder to what Chief Justice John Roberts was saying. We saw voter suppression in the southern states that were covered by the Voting Rights Act, and we saw voter suppression in the northern states that historically had not done voter suppression nearly as much.
John Roberts is a pretty plugged-in guy in terms of GOP politics. Do you think it's conceivable that he wouldn't have known that there were efforts afoot in the Republican Party to undertake major voter disenfranchisement?
I mean, he had to be aware of it, but I think it goes back much longer. I write about Roberts in my book, Give Us the Ballot, about the history of the Voting Rights Act. Roberts was someone who in the 1980s served in the Reagan administration at the time that the Reagan administration was trying to weaken the Voting Rights Act and other civil rights laws. And there was a big fight with the Congress over whether to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, because parts of the Voting Rights Act were temporary and had to be renewed. And Roberts became the point person in the Reagan Justice Department for arguing that the Voting Rights Act either should not be reauthorized or should be as weak as possible. So, I mean, ever since the 1980s, he was out to get this law. He said in his words that the Voting Rights Act would lead to the largest possible intrusions into affairs of the states. He said it would violate so-called norms of colorblindness by prioritizing African Americans over whites. And so he's someone who has been ideologically out to get the Voting Rights Act for over three decades. And so I don't think you can read his opinion without realizing that the history that this guy has in terms of opposition to the Voting Rights Act and other civil rights laws.
Why was Wisconsin such a pivotal state in the 2016 election?
Well, Wisconsin has been a pivotal state for a long time. If you look at the 2000 and 2004 election, Wisconsin was decided by fewer than 10,000 votes. I don't think people realized that it was going to be so close in 2016 because Barack Obama won the state by 7 points in 2012. But there had been a lot of close elections for Scott Walker, recall elections, close elections for the U.S. Senate. And I think Republicans knew that they had to flip one of those blue states that went for Obama. And Wisconsin was one of the key places they wanted to flip. And that that effort really began with the election of Scott Walker in 2011 and the Republican majorities when they passed laws to gut unions, which took away the number one arm of the Democratic Party. They passed laws to gerrymander the map so that Republicans would have the majority in the legislature and Congress for the next decade. And they passed this voter ID law and other changes to make it harder for Democratic leading voters to be able to vote. So they were very systematic about what they were trying to do. They were trying to gut all of the institutions and all of the people that supported the Democratic Party in the state of Wisconsin. And so what Scott Walker and the Republican legislature did in 2011 really bore fruit in the 2016 election when they were able to flip this state at a time that no one thought it would go red.
Voter suppression didn't get a lot of media attention, but it wasn't exactly a secret that this was going on to politically involved people. Why didn't Hillary Clinton do more to go to Wisconsin and shore up her own support if she knew that all these measures were going to be on the ballot to be depressing the Democratic vote?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, clearly the Clinton campaign underestimated the influence of voter suppression, and obviously their polling was off in terms of believing that she had a large lead in Wisconsin. But I mean, I don't fault Hillary so much as I fault the media for not covering this, because there were 25 presidential debates and there wasn't a single question about the gutting of the Voting Rights Act or the attack on voting rights. There were debates during the primary in Wisconsin, and the issue of voter suppression never came up in Wisconsin. The fact that they had a voter ID law, the fact that the laws were changing. And Republicans were very clear about what they wanted to do. A Republican Congressman, Glenn Grothman, said on the night of Wisconsin's primary on April 5th, 2016, that the voter ID law, in his words, was going to help Hillary Clinton win the state of Wisconsin. He was asked, you know, why do you think a Republican is going to win the state of Wisconsin? And he said, Hillary Clinton's the weakest candidate Democrats have ever nominated, and now we have photo ID, and photo ID is going to make a difference as well. There was a trial, and during the trial, it came out that in closed-door meetings, Republicans said behind closed doors they wanted to pass the voter ID law, in their words, because of neighborhoods around Milwaukee and college campuses across the state, meaning African-American voters in Milwaukee and college students were targeted by this law. And it was very obvious what was going on here. It didn't take a rocket science to try to figure out the purpose of this voter ID law. And a lot of people just ignored it until it was too late.
When you think about it, photo IDs are really expensive. And if you're a person of a certain amount of means, you know, that's just part of the cost of doing business, of adulting. But if you're not, doesn't that amount to a poll tax?
It does. And that's a really good point, because I mean, I hear it all the time. Well, everyone has an ID. You know, you need an ID to get on a plane. You need an ID to buy Sudafed, yada, yada, yada. And I would say two things. Number one, Wisconsin shows that about 10% of the electorate, according to a federal court, didn't have strict forms of voter ID, which means a Wisconsin state ID or a driver's license. Secondly, some people had a really hard time getting these IDs because they didn't have underlying documents like a birth certificate, which many people don't have or don't have on them, that you needed to get an ID. Third, everyone I talked to had some sort of ID, but they didn't have the ID that was accepted. For example, I met a ton of people that moved from Illinois to Wisconsin, particularly African-American voters who moved from Chicago to Milwaukee or Madison. They had Illinois IDs. They had Illinois photo IDs. They had Illinois driver's licenses, but they couldn't use that to vote in Wisconsin. And if they wanted to get a Wisconsin ID, they had to trade in their Illinois ID. They had to pay money for a driver's license. There were issues they had. They had to try to get their birth certificates. If people had mistakes on their birth certificates, if people were born in the segregated South and never had a birth certificate, they were in this crazy chicken and egg scenario where they couldn't get the ID they needed because they didn't have the underlying documents they needed to get the ID. So I think it requires a little bit of peeling back the curtain. And as you mentioned, a little bit of empathy to realize that people in poverty, people who move, people who are struggling, they face these real impediments to getting an ID that someone like you or I might not have.
Can you tell us the story of Zach? He was one of the figures in your piece, and I found his story really moving.
Yeah, so when I went to Madison in September of 2016, I met a guy by the name of Zach Moore, who I met through Molly McGrath, who was an organizer helping people get voter IDs. And Zach was a guy who had moved from Chicago to Madison. He was working as a landscaper. He broke his leg. He became homeless, and he wanted to be able to vote. And he had an Illinois photo ID, so he had a photo ID, but he went to the DMV to try to get a Wisconsin ID. And there was a sign at the DMV that said, no birth certificate, no problem. You can get a voter ID, literally a sign right where he was. And he said, I want to get a Wisconsin ID. I have everything. I have my social security number. I have proof of residency. I have my Illinois ID, but I don't have my birth certificate. And they told him at the DMV he had to go back to Illinois and get his birth certificate, even though the sign at the DMV literally said, no birth certificate, no problem. And this was happening all across the state of Wisconsin. Molly McGrath, the organizer I mentioned, her and her mother went undercover, went to all of these different DMVs and said, if we don't have birth certificates, can we get an ID? And basically they were told, no, you can't get one, or B, you have to pay for one, or C, it'll take 6 to 8 weeks to get one. Well, this was late September at that point. The election was going to be over in 6 to 8 weeks. And so there was really a systematic violation, not just of the law itself, but the implementation of the law. And when I wrote about this for The Nation, and then it was also written about in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a federal judge actually ordered an investigation into the state of Wisconsin and basically told them, you guys have done nothing to help people get voter IDs. Either you intentionally didn't do it, or the training was so bad you guys had no idea what was going on. And so this to me is the real evidence of voter suppression, that people tried to get IDs. People tried to vote and weren't able to. It wasn't like there was just a bunch of people sitting around with no ID who made no effort to get one. People went, in some cases, to extraordinary lengths, making multiple trips to the DMV to try to get their IDs, and they weren't able to.
And some of the people you talked to were homeless or insecurely housed, so this was a big sacrifice on their part to be spending time they needed to survive trying to exercise their basic democratic rights.
And the DMV was telling people who are homeless, go back to your home state and get your ID. I mean, these people don't even have somewhere to sleep in Madison, let alone the ability to get on a bus, go back to Illinois, come back to Wisconsin, find their documents. I mean, I didn't know where my birth certificate was, Lindsay, until I got married out of the country. So, I mean, at 30 years old. So, I mean, I think a lot of people just have no idea where their birth certificates are, no idea where a lot of these underlying documents are. And people have had to go to extraordinary lengths to try to get them. And all of these people were qualified to vote. All of these people were registered to vote. All of these people had other forms of ID. There are much easier ways to try to verify who people are than what the state of Wisconsin did. And we know for a fact, indisputably, people were prevented from voting who otherwise should have been able to vote.
How much did voter turnout decline in Wisconsin between 2012 and 2016?
There was a really serious decline in voter turnout. Wisconsin had always basically been right behind Minnesota when it came to voter turnout. It was number two in the nation voter turnout in 2016 and in 2012 and in 2008. And in 2016, voter turnout fell 3.3% in Wisconsin. But it fell in some places more than others. So there was half the decline in turnout was in the city of Milwaukee, where 70% of the state's African-American population lives. And if you look at the statistics, in white middle-class areas of the city, voter turnout barely fell. In predominantly black and low-income areas of the city, voter turnout fell by up to 30%. And the head of elections there said that he believes that was because of the voter ID law in large part. And he told me that he believes that it changed the outcome in the state of Wisconsin. There was also a study by the University of Wisconsin, a very carefully done study, that surveyed people who didn't vote in 2016 in Milwaukee and Madison, the two most Democratic areas of the state. They asked them why. And 1 in 10 people who didn't vote in 2016 cited the voter ID law as a reason why they didn't vote. So that's up to 23,000 people who are prevented from voting in two counties alone because of this law. And Donald Trump only won the state by 22,000 votes. So I don't think you can do a perfect apples to apples comparison, but we know from both my reporting, from studies, from talking to election officials, that the number of people disenfranchised is in the thousands in Wisconsin.
So he won by about 23,000 votes, and there were like 45,000 votes that were discovered to have been suppressed by the study?
I mean, if you look at the University of Wisconsin study, they found that up to 23,000 people were deterred or prevented from voting in Milwaukee and Madison. If you extrapolate statewide, which is not a perfect scientific comparison, but if you extrapolate statewide, that's up to 45,000 people statewide who would have been prevented from voting. Now, they didn't do this study in all of the other counties in Wisconsin. There's obviously going to be some rural counties and some other places where people didn't have as much problems with the ID law. But I think it's also fair to say that there were places they didn't survey, like in Racine or Kenosha or college campuses in other parts of the state that would have also had big issues with the voter ID law. And so I think it's very fair to say that tens of thousands of people were disenfranchised according to this study from the University of Wisconsin. There's also other data points that show that voter ID laws can decrease turnout by 2 to 3%, which in a state like Wisconsin is enough to swing the outcome of the election.
Are there any other states that voter suppression might have thrown to Trump?
Well, I think there's other states in which voter suppression played a role in the election, and it's hard to point out exactly what the overall impact on the outcome was, but I just talk about a few places, like in North Carolina, where they closed a tremendous amount of polling places in majority black areas, or in Ohio, where they eliminated early voting and purged people from the voting rolls, or in Florida, where they just disenfranchised ex-offenders. So if you serve your time, you get out of jail, you just can't vote in Florida. And one in four African Americans in the state weren't even able to participate in the 2016 election because of that. So there were a lot of under-the-radar changes that I think had an impact. But I think the greatest impact was in Wisconsin because of how close it was and how bad the law was.
But you're not arguing that that was the only factor. There were other reasons why Democratic turnout might have been down in Wisconsin besides voter suppression, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I say that in the piece. I mean, it's funny, you know, I've gotten really good feedback to the article, but a lot of people are like, there's other factors. And I'm like, there's literally a sentence in my piece that says there was no one thing that changed the election. And I say there was Jim Comey, there was racism, there was sexism, there was Russian interference, there was a lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, there was a backlash to the first black president. I mean, there were tons of factors, but the whole purpose of writing the piece was to say voter suppression was a factor. And so many people are arguing that it had no impact on the election. And that's just completely demonstrably false. It absolutely had an impact on the election. We know from talking to voters, we know from talking to election officials, we know from numerous academic studies and other data points that have been done. And even if voter suppression had no impact on the election, we know for a fact that many qualified Americans were prevented from voting in the year 2016, more than 50 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And I find that outrageous and scandalous, something that needs a lot more attention.
Absolutely. And when it's that close, even if it's a small factor, any one of the small factors could have tipped the balance.
Well, absolutely. And the thing that's annoying to me is that people are treating it as an either-or thing, saying that it was lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton that reduced turnout. Well, that's absolutely true. But think about this. If you're already not that excited to vote, and then you know that you have to find your birth certificate and go to the DMV and pay for an ID or try to negotiate a free ID, and you're already not that motivated to vote, well, that might tip it, that you're just say, forget it, I'm just not going to vote at all because I don't want to deal with this process. So people don't think like, oh, well, I would have voted, but I didn't have ID, or yes, I'm going to vote because I have ID. I mean, I think it's a little bit more complicated in the calculus. And the whole thing was to put up enough barriers just to dissuade people from participating. And I will say, it wasn't just voter ID. Wisconsin made it harder to register to vote. They made it harder to count absentee ballots. They eliminated deputies that did statewide voter registration drives. Scott Walker and the Republican legislature passed 33 different election changes that undermined democracy in that state. And so Wisconsin, which I think is really important to note, is a state that has historically been one of the leaders in voting rights, was one of the worst states for voting rights in the last election. And that to me is what's so interesting about Wisconsin. It's not North Carolina. It's not Alabama. It's not Texas. It's not a state that has the same kind of history. And so, as I say in the piece, if voter suppression works in Wisconsin, which has a history of high participation, a history of high turnout, I think it could work anywhere in the country.
Why do you think there's so much resistance from these otherwise progressive people to even considering that voter suppression played a role?
I think a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about the partisanship of it. I think a lot of people in the media are uncomfortable saying Republicans are trying to disenfranchise Democrats. I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with the racial dynamics of it, saying that in many cases, white Republicans are trying to disenfranchise black and brown Democrats. I think that some wings of the party just want to blame Hillary Clinton for everything, as opposed to saying that there are other factors at work here. So, I mean, it's very easy to just sit back and blame Hillary Clinton for not going to Wisconsin. And, you know, and there's lots of fair criticism to make of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. But at the same time, I think we have to be honest that there were other factors that shaped the election. And I think if the Democratic Party doesn't make this a big issue, it's going to get worse in 2018 and 2020, because now Republicans have control of the courts. So the courts are going to be less sympathetic to these laws. We have Trump's Election Integrity Commission spreading all these lies about voter fraud to implement new measures. We have the President of the United States peddling the largest voter fraud lies of all, and a lot of Republicans believing that 3 to 5 million people voted legally. So I think this is a wake-up call for Democrats that if they don't really organize, and not just Democrats, but outside groups too, if they don't organize against these laws well ahead of time, it's going to get a whole lot worse in the next election or the next two elections.
What's the American Legislative Exchange Council, and what role has it played in shaping various states' election laws?
The American Legislative Exchange Council, otherwise known as ALEC, is basically a consortium where state legislatures are paired with corporations to write model bills. So, you know, all of the major corporations give a lot of money to ALEC. They attend conferences with state legislators, and they basically draft legislation for them to introduce. And after the 2008 election, ALEC drafted mock voter ID legislation. And virtually identical legislation was being introduced in Wisconsin and Texas and Pennsylvania all across the country based on the ALEC mock legislation. So when I see state legislatures all of a sudden restricting voting rights, restricting women's rights to choose, attacking unions, state legislators are not that organized. For every state to be introducing virtually identical pieces of legislation, someone has to be behind that effort. And ALEC has been behind a lot of these efforts in various states.
How have the priorities changed now that Jeff Sessions has taken over the Justice Department in terms of voting rights?
Well, the Justice Department has just completely changed positions. They've gone from under President Obama fighting voter ID laws and fighting voter purges and fighting cutbacks in early voting to supporting them. And there are, you know, two really important cases, the Texas voter ID law and the Ohio voter purge case, which is going before the Supreme Court, where Jeff Sessions' Justice Department has already reversed the Obama administration's opposition to these kind of things. And not only that, Jeff Sessions said in an oversight hearing before the Senate that the DOJ is coordinating with Chris Kobach's quote-unquote Election Integrity Commission, which Kobach's commission is supposed to be an advisory commission. They're not supposed to be working, at least without full disclosure, with the Justice Department, with the Department of Homeland Security. So it also seems like there are some sort of coordination between the Justice Department and Kobach's commission, which I think is very worrisome. Sessions is also someone himself who has a very long history of opposition to voting rights ever since he was a U.S. attorney in Alabama in the 1980s, and he prosecuted African Americans for trying to help people cast absentee ballots, which was a very, very controversial trial at the time, and one of the reasons why he was blocked as a federal judge in 1986. So I think the Justice Department under Sessions is one of the clearest examples of a real sea change between the Obama administration and the Trump administration.
Can you elaborate on the Kobach Voting Integrity Commission and why it's leading people to essentially self-disenfranchise out of fear?
Well, people are concerned because the Kobach Commission has requested voter data from all 50 states, and people are very concerned what they're going to do with that voter data, how secure it is, whether it's going to be used to spread lies about voter fraud, whether it's going to be used to put in place new restrictions on voting. I just had a new article that came out this week about Chris Kobach's cross-check program. So 32 states are part of this program called cross-check, where they compare voter data among states to search for double voting. And CrossCheck is an incredibly insecure program. It has huge security flaws. States are uploading their voter data on not encrypted FTP sites, so FTP sites that could easily be hacked. They're sending around emails and passwords to access these vote systems just in plain text of emails, like you and I are exchanging to set up this interview, which could easily be hacked. They are releasing names of people that are flagged by CrossCheck without redacting the information. So this is all the reasons why Americans are afraid of the Trump Election Commission having their voter data. And I think it's an absolute mistake to unregister. I think that's exactly what Kobach wants you to do. At the same time, I have a huge amount of fear about why this commission is requesting this voter data, because we've never seen the federal government request voter data from all 50 states before. And Kobach has such a spotty record, both in running his cross-check program and just in passing voter suppression laws in Kansas, that I think people are right to be worried about this.
You mentioned in the cover story that the ACLU and various voting rights groups are changing their strategy and not just looking to the courts to fix these problems. Can you describe what else they're doing now?
Yeah, I think this is a really important recognition that the courts are not enough, that with more and more Trump appointees, it's going to be harder to challenge these laws in the courts. And so the ACLU has launched a 50-state effort to try to promote voting rights at the local and state level. It's their Let People Vote campaign. And so basically every ACLU chapter now is working on voting rights in some capacity. And the membership of the ACLU has quadrupled since the election to 1.6 million members. So they have a lot of people that can work on this. They've also hired Molly McGrath, who is an organizer I profile in the piece, who helps people get voter IDs. And she's an extraordinary person that has done a really tremendous amount of work, but it's so difficult to do this kind of work. I mean, people who have issues with their IDs, they don't have birth certificates, they don't have stable residency sometimes, they don't have financial means, and to try to get these people their documents, take them to the DMV is incredibly labor intensive. And so, I mean, I think it's great that ACLU has Molly, but I think there needs to be thousands of Mollies all across the country to help people get IDs because of the barriers that are being erected.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program. For those of you just tuning in, my guest today has been Ari Berman of Mother Jones Magazine, and you can read his cover story on voter suppression in the Wisconsin election on our website.
Thanks so much, Lindsay.
And now it's time for recommended reading, a handpicked selection to make you a lean, mean, debating machine for Thanksgiving dinner. Today's selection is by Zachary Fryer Biggs in Newsweek, and it's called The Hillary Clinton Uranium One Conspiracy Theory Doesn't Make Any Sense. Read this and watch Joy Reid's MSNBC takedown, both linked on the Breach webpage, and you'll be ready to put your conservative relatives in their place on the big day. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Nora Hurley for Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Follow Rewire at Rewire_news for the latest on the issues that matter most. See you next week!